are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people who make them and do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates or advertisers. Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous planet we call Earth, thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. And those of you joining us for the very first time, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. As the night begins to settle all across the United States of America, it's always time for the Kevin Smith Show. Kevin Smith Show rules the night, and you are why. You are why this show rules the night, because you are here and you always call in with great questions and probing comments, and you make it happen. Now, you may have noticed, those of you who have been over to the website, you may have noticed that there is no blurb for tonight's show. And the reason there is no blurb for tonight's show is because we have spent the afternoon in crossed communications. And because of that, we didn't know if the guest that was supposed to be with us was indeed going to be with us. Couldn't get in touch with the guest in time, and had to arrange very quickly for a backup interview. And so it's been all of that going on. I take full responsibility for that, and we'll let it go at that. But I do want to tell you that we've got a great show for you tonight. A few weeks ago, we had as our guest, and you'll remember this, he's been on the show a couple of times, but we had as our guest Robert Morningstar, who is the editor at UFODigest.com. Which is, of course, a great and major website for those of you who are interested in UFOs and extraterrestrials and UFO sightings and incidents and so forth. It's a great site. And he told me, he said, look, this was the last time he was with us after the show. He said, you know, if you ever have a situation where you've got to have a backup interview, short notice, feel free to give me a call. Well, I gave him a call not too many minutes ago, and he was ready, willing, and able to do so, and said that he would be more than happy to be my guest this evening. And I had already communicated with our producer that I would like to have him scheduled to be on the show again as soon as possible. It just happened a little sooner than I had anticipated. And so Robert Morningstar is going to be our guest this evening, and he always has a lot of insight into the things that are going on in the world of ufology. You know, some people say ufology, some people say UFOlogy. I don't know which it is, but whichever it is, he is really up on the information and the news about what's going on in that world. And I want particularly to talk with him a little bit this evening about this Edgar Mitchell thing, and see where that stands. As you know, we had the host of the show from England who had interviewed Edgar Mitchell that started all of this. We had him as a guest earlier this week. and quite interesting guest as well. But let's see if we can get a little more in-depth information from our guest this evening, Robert Morningstar, and we'll do that when we come back from this break.
Most of the great music you hear right here on Steeleye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com.
Thousands of brave young men and women returned from the war, many of whom have suffered devastating injuries and made supreme sacrifice for our freedom. You can help these American heroes, and you really do have the keys to change the future in your hands. Fans for Vet is an actual organization that acquires new and used vehicles by donation, motorhomes, and sometimes even boats for placement with disabled and homeless veterans. We make necessary repairs to the vehicle. We fit it with handicap assistance hardware, driving controls, wheelchair ramps, and then we give these vehicles to the disabled veteran or the homeless veteran free of charge. You can change a life and show your appreciation by donating a vehicle that you no longer need to. VansForVets.org. Please contact us at www.VansForVets.org. Thank you. God bless America.
10, 9.
Alien Seeker News has blasted off and is providing a new and important resource for everyone interested in UFOs, aliens, alien abductions, Bigfoot, Chupacabra, and more. Featuring five of the top UFO radio talk shows, lots of information and articles in free forums, Alien Seeker News has launched on its journey to greatness. Go to AlienSeekerNews.com, register for the free forums, and get the classic Flying Saucers Are Real by Major Donald Kehoe as a free ebook. Join today.
Show unique in the galaxy.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As I said, my guest this evening is Robert Morningstar, and this has all happened so quickly that we really didn't even have time to do what I normally do. I call it the pre-flight checklist, and one of the things that I do is get the volume set right for the telephones, but we'll just jump in and see what happens. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kevin. Good to hear you. Good to be here.
Well, listen, I want to tell you how much I appreciate you for being willing sort of at really the last minute to step in and talk with us this evening. And I don't know if you heard the first few minutes of the show where I explained this to people, I had already asked the producer to send you an email and get you back on the show as soon as mm-hmm. possible. I was thinking either Friday or sometime next week. And then, you know, we got this all this communication crossed up and everything today. And
right.
So here we are now.
Well, I'm happy because I can do it today, and I might not have been able to do it tomorrow or Saturday. But let's take the opportunity.
Let me get you to comment on something before we get into the Edgar Mitchell story.
Mm-hmm.
Today...
NASA announced that they were confirming the presence of water on Mars. They said that previously it had been speculation just based on instrument readings. But now they've actually scooped up some stuff, put it in the little oven on the Phoenix lander, baked it off, and it's got water in it. What do you think about that?
Well, of course, that's great news, and I'm just as excited today as I was in 1994 when Richard Hoagland told us all of that.
So, yeah, isn't that
great?
Honestly,
and
isn't it amazing?
Up with Richard Hoagland.
Yeah, it honestly is amazing, isn't it? That you know, Hoagland has been sort of the front bumper on the car that's leading the bandwagon. People, you know, a lot of these scientists poo-pooed what he was saying back then and made fun of it and ridiculed him for it. But time and time and time and time again, he has been correct.
And especially about Mars. And, you know, he's a man who's done his homework, and he's a very intelligent and excellent analyst. And he can take very varied classes of information and make really, really insightful inferences that in time come true, like this issue about the water.
You know, so, one of the things in the story, one of the things that was in the news story about this this whole event that I had to chuckle at a little bit, you remember when you were on last time, we did talk a little bit about Mars, and we talked about the rover had early on, I forget if it was Spirit or Opportunity, but had taken a picture of the area behind the rover where it had already traveled, and it showed the tracks, and it looked like mud.
Yes, it did. That's what that was my impression too. That it was driven through a big muddy and left a muddy splotch of something there. But yeah, that's where that was quite clear. You get the gleam and the sheen on the picture changed right there at that spot. But
well,
it was too much for them to believe.
Now, you know, the thing that is really, really interesting about that is that, pardon me.
Sure.
Let me get a sip of coffee.
That's a good idea.
The thing that's really interesting about that is in this latest story. The latest story is that you know they scooped up some stuff and then they couldn't get it to drop out of the scoop into the oven. It wouldn't turn loose.
Right. I was wondering about that. What was the clumping agent?
Yeah. And then they tried it again and they had the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then they tried it again, but this time when they scooped, they let the soil, or whatever they scooped, remain in the scoop for 2 days before they tried to dump it into the oven. And then they were able to dump it into the oven and found that it had water vapor. I think the simple Occam's razor answer is the reason it wouldn't fall out of the scoop into the oven is because it was mud.
Sounds logical to me.
Yeah, it was too wet.
Mm-hmm.
So
could it be that there were clumps of bacteria that are still holding it together?
Yeah. Well, and they're not. You know, they. What's interesting too are the divergent statements that have come out. For one thing.
Well, brief me because this is news to me. I've been really busy with a lot of other things today, and I must have missed this press release. So I'd be.
What I'm about to say goes back really, I guess, about 3-4 weeks back. There was an article that came out where the lead scientist down at Tucson, that's running the Phoenix program, said about the soil. That after they had analyzed it, he said, "This is just like the soil in your backyard. You could grow asparagus in it."
Oh, that's pretty a significant statement, I would say.
It is. And then, right after that, there was a story that came out that said that when they analyzed it, they found no organic compounds. Well, that would not be like the soil in my backyard.
that's excellent logic, of course. You know, there's such contradictory information, you know, double speak, double talk that comes out of NASA.
Yeah, well, now this guy down in Tucson is not actually NASA, so yeah, I'm inclined to believe his statement for that reason, plus he was first one to the bat, you know? So, I think it probably is just like the soil in your backyard, and now we know it has water. If it's got water, it has organic compounds, no doubt.
Well, you know, just to clarify my statement about the inconsistencies in some of the NASA so-called facts, they tell us that Mars's atmosphere is extremely thin, primarily carbon dioxide, that the air pressure, let's call it the atmospheric pressure, is very, very low. And yet, they make another statement. They show you geological formations that say they say were carved by 200-mile-an-hour winds. They regularly show us photographs of planetary-wide dust storms that envelop the whole planet and obstruct views of terrain features. And those two things just don't go together. You just can't have a very extremely thin, low-pressure atmosphere that is so powerful that it could race at 200 miles an hour and create enough pressure to put a lid on the Hellas Basin, which is basically a sea of CO2. And this is something that I saw myself during Mars' closest approach to Earth in 60,000 years in 2003. I was flabbergasted to see the Hellas Basin spewing vapors as if it had just been hit by a huge asteroid impact. And the following day, I mean, at that moment, I realized, oh, my God, you know, they haven't told us the truth about anything about Mars. The air glow, the aurora australoborealis, I call it. They have an aurora on Mars that is so immense. It's the arcs of plasma go from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere. They don't just hang around the North Pole and South Pole as they do on Earth. And they, over the last couple of years, all these things that I described from my sighting of Mars and my observation of it three times, three nights in New York City, looking at Mars August 26th, 27th, 28th, 2003, it was stunning. And I realized what junk has been fed to all of us on the Discovery Channel with all of those purported images of Mars, Hubble images of Mars. They're computer renderings. They're dehancements of Mars. And, you know, there's this big issue about whether the sky on Mars is really red or blue. And, you know, every indication of that I've seen is that it has a blue sky. And they alter the colors. And, of course, Hoagland and other researchers have been saying that NASA has been changing the colors not only of Mars but of the moon for ages, you know, turning down the gain, for example, on color images of the moon. And very soon, with this new information that's coming out in the Hasselblad photos, you'll see the moon is resplendent, has many colors. It's not that dull, dead metal gray silver that you always see. It's got various hues.
How do you know about the moon having colors? How do we know that?
Well, some of the things, photographs from my point of view, photographs in particular, people don't pay attention to enough of the information. They see generally the superficial stuff that's been released over years, but if you delve into the Apollo Hasselblad magazines, if you look, for example, you know, one little example that I can give you is if you pay attention to that famous scene where I think Alan Shepard uses the golf club and wails on the golf ball into orbit over the moon. If you look closely at the chrome on the golf club that he uses, you will see rainbows splattering. You know, as he swings through it, you'll see a flash of rainbow colors coming off the chrome of the club. If you look at the paintings that Alan Bean did when he came back from the moon, and you compare them with the photographs. Now, Alan Bean, like other astronauts, so all other astronauts who went to the moon, are basically, you know, they are restrained from discussing or divulging in extreme details all of the things that they saw.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I believe that this is kind of a programming thing that occurs, you know, a certain kind of basically intimidation and mind control that happened to all of them, you know, to keep national security, whatever excuse they gave them. But Alan Bean became quite an accomplished painter, and he painted what he remembered of the moon. Now, when you look at the paintings that he did, what he remembers he saw, and you compare them with the photos of the same scene as released by NASA, there's no comparison. I mean, he's painting a resplendently glorious, colorful moon, and all of the Apollo photos are either black and white, of course, or the color ones have been toned down. And I think there was a fellow named Steve, there is a fellow named Steve Troy, who put out an article, The True Colors of the Moon, which you can find by going to enterprisemission.com. So I investigated this, and I found a wide variety of colors and hues. Of course, some of it depends on the angle of the sun on the moon at the time. But there are some photos of the moon that look to me like I'm looking at a piece of Utah, you know, that red.
Hmm.
So,
You know, I was not aware of that. I know about Mars colors being fooled around with by NASA, mm-hmm. but I certainly was not aware that the moon had additional colors other than that, as you said, steel gray.
Mm-hmm. Well, I encourage you to invite Richard Hoagland to be on your program, and he'll really give you the details about the alteration of colors that go on with it, and the manipulation of details and images in some of these photos. But as I mentioned the other day, I think when I called in, that NASA is struggling to reform itself, you know, with the new administrator, Michael Griffin,
yeah.
who was the former president of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, which was, in fact, a union of scientists who were not, you know, party hacks. They were not, you know, yes men, and they were involved in, the organization is very interested in astronautics and rocketry, and they formed an organization, scientific organizations of scientists who did independent studies in aeronautics and astronautics because they would not toe the NASA party line. So when the Columbia disaster occurred, I was really hoping that Dr. Michael Griffin would get the job, and he did get it, and it's a whole paradigm shift that NASA has to go through. But NASA's like an old dinosaur, you know, and it's been plodding along in the same direction, and it's got a lot of momentum in this kind of in this direction, and it's hard to turn a dinosaur when it's racing, you know, very happy, very fat on the funding and the way that they've done things. But I think that Dr. Griffin is slowly altering the general policies. But, you know, you think, oh, the guy's a director, he can tell anybody what to do. But inside any organization, there are enclaves of influence and power, and they're very resistant to change when they are the elite and they are the wielders of the power, most of it financial power, which is, you know, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. So, Dr. Griffin, I think, is...
Is that original to you?
No, I think some astronauts said it in the right stuff, of course.
Yeah, no bucks, no Bucks, Buck Rogers. That's a good saying.
Yeah, it was one of the wonderful scenes in The Right Stuff, if you'll recall. When they're asking for the window.
Speaking though about NASA and about the moon, let's talk about Edgar Mitchell. Let's go ahead and dive off into that. Now, let me preface whatever else you and I are going to say with a quote from Edgar Mitchell that was published this week. He was in an interview with a ABC affiliate television station, and they did a pretty good report, actually. It lacked chuckle factor, and that's good. And it was a pretty good interview, but he was pretty tough on the press as well. And he said, you know, it's interesting to me, and this is a quote, "I've been saying the same damn things for 10 years, and now suddenly it's world news." Has he been saying the same things for 10 years?
Well, yes, actually. You know, I had an exchange with Brad Steiger, you know, the very well-known writer on the paranormal, UFOs.
Sure.
He sent me something because somebody was challenging Mitchell's statement, you know, as possibly, you know, a ploy, being a mouthpiece for the government, etc. And I wrote back, I said, the important thing to notice is that Edgar Mitchell has not changed his story one bit in the last 10 years. And the difference today is that the media is paying attention to it in all seriousness. That's what really has to be looked at. And I just think he's a very courageous man, and I'm very proud of him for having stated it so explicitly. I feel that he's emerging, you know. He's getting on in years, but he still has all his faculties, and his memories of the moon and his experiences are a treasure.
We are into a break, Robert, and so we'll have to hold it there.
We will continue with Robert Morningstar when we come back, folks.
This out. Never have a struggle to understand just what life's about. When I hold my six string, I close my eyes and I absorb. Just have to figure out the secrets of the magic door. I tough, so I huff and I puff and I scream, so I smile and I grin and I just want. My
And we are back. My guest is
Robert Morningstar. And Robert, during the break, I got an email that requested that I ask something that I had intended to ask anyway, but I'm certainly glad to be reminded of it. And I just want to say to the person who sent the email, Eric, hang in there, buddy. We're going to get to it. Not yet. I did get it.
Okay.
All right.
Great.
So now, Edgar Mitchell has been saying the same thing for the past 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, though, in this interview that, and we're talking about an interview that was with a British radio station.
Kerrang.
Yeah, Kerrang Radio.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is the first time where he said the government has been covering it up.
Yes, basically. I think he actually said that statement on the Larry King show.
Oh, did he?
Yes, he did. That's when he said the government has been covering it up and that he had spoken to an admiral in the Pentagon who told him he was going to get to the bottom of it. He tracked it down as far as he could go. And when he found out the name of the person who was in charge of the program, he demanded to know and be briefed because he was part of the Pentagon. And the fellow just bluntly told him, "Well, Admiral, you don't have a need to know. Thank you. Have a good day." Period. That was it. So that's the problem that we have, you see, this. And people ask me, you know, why do you think the UFO issue is important? And I think it's important for two reasons. One, getting to the truth. Two, the need for a major paradigm shift in human thinking, because the current paradigm, scientific paradigm, is leading us to self-destruction. It's been exploited for all the wrong reasons, and I believe that actually truth has been suppressed. And it's my hope that the UFO issue is such a revolutionary issue that it's not going to change, not only going to change science and human consciousness, but the politics of this country as well. Because I am against secrecy, tyranny. Tyranny, the first weapon of tyranny is secrecy.
Yeah, but now, and surely you're not against all secrecy.
Not all secrecy, but who is to know what is a valid secret and in the national interest when there is no oversight and there's no knowledge even of who is in charge of this control machinery, the information and disinformation centers. And I think it's important because in the name of liberty and security, we are selling out, surrendering our rights. And I remind everyone, you know, of the words of Thomas Jefferson and paraphrased by others of the Revolutionary period. Anyone who would trade a little bit of liberty for a little security is worthy of neither. And I believe that the UFO...
Well, okay, but let me ask you a question, though.
Okay.
Because you know, we've talked about this before, and I have with other guests, and I'm curious. Some secrecy is okay, and of course I think everyone would say, well, you got to have some secrets because you can't just let everything, all of your technological secrets out, because if you did that, you have nations, rogue nations, that would use them against you. So we got to have some secrecy. But then you have brought up, as we have heard before, a real issue, and that is, so who is in charge of this secret about UFOs? Who is it that's in charge? Who decides who gets to know? I think most of us would assume the president certainly would have the right to know, and yet we have been informed, whether it's accurate or not, I can't say for sure, but we've been informed by some pretty good sources that there have been presidents who have been simply locked out of information about UFOs and not briefed on it. So yeah. Then who is it that's in charge? Now, here's the question. If we put it in your hands to design a system for deciding who's which secrets are going to be secret and which ones are going to be let out, who would you put in charge?
Well, you see, I think we already have committees that are supposed to be in charge of that, but they are ignored by whoever is holding the information. The Congress is supposed to have oversight, and they have various committees, intelligence committees, the military appropriations committees, on and on, committee after committee, and yet not a single one of them can get an answer, a straight answer, for example, from the Air Force on UFOs. Stephen Schiff, the late congressman from New Mexico, tried. He was given the Stonewall. Clinton claims to have tried to find out. He was given the Stonewall. And who are these people who think, I mean, I would be shocked, especially if I were president, to be told, you are president, but you don't need to know, and so have a good day, too, you know?
I think any president would.
The power has been usurped.
Yeah. Yeah, by whom,
by
though?
Agencies. By operators of secret. Black ops is as good a name. Black agency, black operations, as good a name as any for an organization that hides its own name from the people that fund it. So some people think that it's the NSA. But the NSA, I think, takes the heat. But the ones that I think are really in charge of this from the earliest period, I think, is the Atomic Energy Commission, myself.
The Atomic Energy Commission?
Yeah,
because, you know, usually when we hear people, especially when we open the phone lines and callers are sort of railing against the silence, we usually either hear from them it's the CIA or it's the NSA.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever heard anybody call the show and say it was the Atomic Energy Commission. Why do you think it's them?
Well, this is going back to some of the earliest UFO apparitions, you might call them manifestations. I like the word manifestations. They manifest. They show up. They manifest. They're gone. You know? They show and a little show and tell. Peekaboo, I see you. Bye-bye. But some of the earliest and most disconcerting UFO incidents involved atomic energy plants, Tennessee Valley Commission, Oak Ridge. I gave a lecture to the New York Disclosure Project back in, I think it was September of last year. And after the lecture, a fellow came up and talked to me. His name was Tom. And later on, he wrote me a really long letter, and he told me that his parents had worked at Oak Ridge, and that when he was a little boy, it was around 46 or 47, they were driving in Oak Ridge, and they saw a UFO come in right over the facility, and in the blink of an eye, just, as they say, you know, just gone. And this is one of the earliest incidents, but their interest in the atomic energy programs that we have. Why did Roswell happen in New Mexico? You know, Nye, that guy, Bill Nye, on the Larry King show,
mm-hmm.
He was saying, you know, why don't they show up in New York? Why would they go to, you know, basically saying a podunk state like New Mexico, trying to deflect attention and distract people? Well, friend, you know, New Mexico was where Los Alamos was, Sandia was, the Trinity test site was.
When it came to atomic energy, New Mexico was and is a happening place.
And Roswell, the 509th bomb group, was there. So, you know, comics like Bill Nye get on there and they use a little bit of ridicule, a little sarcasm, and nobody responds to them on points like that. Hell, where else but New Mexico were you going to find the greatest concentration of atom bombs on the planet in those years? Right.
So you think the Atomic Energy Commission from the very earliest days were in charge of these secrets?
Yes, they're big players. They were big players.
But see, now, do they have jurisdiction over the military?
Well, I think there must be some kind of liaison between them, because they oversee all nuclear issues, and of course, who develops the nuclear weaponry, and who oversees the contractors, the different industrial facilities that manufacture components for not just nuclear weapons, but, you know, the big industry now in the future. They're still going to try to push nuclear energy as the solution, despite, you know, the Chernobyl-like dangers.
All right, now, let me ask you this. While this train of thought is passing through the station, let me grab it.
Okay.
You're making a link to the Atomic Energy Commission as being who is behind the secrets here on UFOs. Are you doing that on the basis of logic, or have you seen some Freedom of Information documents, or have you received some information about it?
Well, I have seen and read some documents relating to their great concern with UFO incidents in the 50s and 60s near nuclear sites. But also, importantly, you know, when it comes to energy, the Atomic Energy Commission is also has oversight over the energy grid of the United States, and the blackouts that occurred in the 60s and 70s in New York is a prime example. The blackout that occurred in the late 70s in France, which was a national blackout. UFOs were all over their nuclear plants and all over their electrical plants, and poof, in December of 78, I believe, the great French national blackout, which we never hear about. So the blackouts happen almost at will. Rolling blackouts over Central America that I'm aware of, that fleets of UFOs overflying Costa Rica and other times, other Central American countries, each says they went over the different regions, blink, out, town went out, next city went out, and so on. So there is this very, very important effect, energetic effect that UFOs have on the power grid, and a great curiosity that they have about atomic plants, like the Black Triangle in 1985 over the Indian Point nuclear facility here in New York. I flew over Indian Point many times as a pilot over the last 25 years. Had the privilege of flying up and down the Hudson and across the Northeast and many other places on the planet. And I flew over the Indian Point nuclear facility many times before it became forbidden territory after 9/11. And the place is huge. And the description of the UFO that came over it and loitered for 20 minutes over the nuclear facility in 1985. It's told in Night Feet by J. Allen Hynek and Philip Imbrogno. And this thing covered the whole facility. They had surveillance cameras that captured the whole event, but no one surveillance camera had a scope or a span that it could contain an image of the whole craft. This thing was 1,000 feet or so long. We've all now heard about aircraft carrier size UFOs over the English Channel and even bigger sizes. Well, this is one of the earliest ones. This is right up here.
What happened to those videos?
Well, here's the point. The videos were there. Investigation came in. The Atomic Energy Commission came in, grabbed them, and like Mr. Callahan, James Callahan, who was talking, third man in the FAA, talking down in Washington about the Alaska 747 incident. The CIA came into his office, took all of their material, took all of their tapes, radar data.
Robert, we're into a break. We'll have to pick it up there on the other side. My guest, Robert Morningstar, and hot stuff about UFOs and Edgar Mitchell. We'll be back.
evidently the same. Strange variations in the way we play the game. Timeless evolution of the tools that we use. Pieces to the puzzle, or maybe just clues. Spinning through you, spinning through me too.
Kevin Smith here. Do you have your Kevin Smith Show t-shirt yet?
No?
Well, let today be the day you step into the world of galactic fashion. Visit the Kevin Smith Show online store and get yours today.
All right, we are back, and
Robert, I had to interrupt you, but we were talking about the UFO's interest, apparent interest, in all of the nuclear plants, and but now you said that you have seen some documents indicating the Atomic Energy Agency was very interested in these UFO events, and then this event that you were telling us about at Indian Point. The security cameras got shots of this craft, but those have never been released, have they?
No, they have never been released, and they're still sealed up. And I don't know if anybody has tried under now, under the new, freedom of information laws, to try to get them. But most of the time when people ask for specific things like this, you get the runaround, which is those tapes don't exist.
They may not exist now.
Well, that's true too. That's the way they tell the truth. They destroy the tape and they can the tapes don't exist.
Well, that may be the case, but what I had in mind is that just over time, tapes deteriorate.
Yeah, and you would think that there would be preservation, of certain really important things.
Well, we would hope so.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
On this subject, what is this group? Who is this group? Who really controls it? And what's their real name? I use the acronym DISC, which comes from the Torbit document. Have you ever read the Torbit document? It's really related to the JFK assassination.
I don't recognize it by that name, no.
Okay. Well, nobody really knows his name, but Torbit said that there existed within the defense industry something called the Defense Intelligence Security Command. So the acronym was DISC. And I thought, that's a really strange, interesting acronym. And this was only relating to the JFK assassination itself, curiously enough, this week, Dr. Robert Wood did a press release on the Byrne memo. The Byrne Memo is one of the MJ-12 documents, and I saw it about a year and a half ago when they put it up on their website, and I jumped out of my seat at the contents of it. Purportedly, it was a memo, a carbon copy of an original document that was supposed to be destroyed. It was supposed to be burned, but whoever was doing the burning saw it and saved it. And somehow it got to Robert Wood and Ryan Wood. So they published it, and I am a pretty well-known expert in the JFK assassination, you know, having worked on it for many, many years. I exposed the doctoring of the Zapruder film, the doctoring, the alteration of the medical evidence. Well, this memo relates to, it has certain coded words inside it that refer to President Kennedy, the UFO issue, his code name, Lancer, wet weather, which is a euphemism in intelligence and counterintelligence, for wet works. It means liquidation. It means assassination.
Assassination, yeah.
And it referenced, and it specifically mentioned the 5412 group. And the 5412 group was the assassination group that was headed by Richard Nixon to knock off Castro. And many people believe that that group was turned around and used on to terminate John F. Kennedy. And it seems that not only, I mean, he had so many.
Now, is there actual evidence for that, or is it just suspicion and smoke in the air?
Evidence for what? The 5412 group?
Yeah, for the 5412 group having been involved in the assassination.
Well, the way the organization was set up appears to have been, and we know this well from going back to Jack Anderson and the Johnny Roselli connections, you know, with making a liaison between CIA and the mafia to knock off Castro. That is very well documented. And so the 5412 committee is the committee that has had the planning, overall planning, logistics, who to get where and what and when to do the job. For example, there's a story that Kennedy might have been killed in Chicago, and that they had two patsies up there in Chicago ready to frame, like Oswald down in Florida, New Orleans, and Dallas, I mean, because Oswald moved around quite a bit down there, or the two Oswalds did. But regardless, it's pretty well documented that the 5412 committee was a group that was in charge of plans to terminate Castro. And Kennedy's close call with nuclear holocaust, his deal with Khrushchev to remove the missiles from Cuba in return for our removal of Jupiter missiles from Turkey, which is a part of the story that's rarely told. It was a quid pro quo. It wasn't just a one-sided thing, although they wanted the American public to think that we browbeat the Russians and just getting the hell out of here with their missiles. Now, there was a trade. We took out, you know, old missile technology, the Jupiters, out of Turkey, and they purportedly took their Luna rockets and other intermediate range ballistic missiles home too. But again, here we have things that the Atomic Energy Commission would definitely be involved with, all of these things: industrial development of nuclear energy, military development of nuclear energy, UFO interest in nuclear facilities. Robert Hastings, for example, who's done this.
Yeah, he was on the show a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, yes. And he was on Larry King. And Robert's work, I hold it in great esteem because he's such a dedicated investigator, researcher. And it's years now, probably 4 years, 5 years, that I've been reading his work and staying in touch with him. And all of his material deals with UFOs at nuclear missile sites, B-52 bases, encounters airborne, and missiles getting knocked out of their their trajectories by UFOs flying rings around them at 8,000 miles an hour to 12,000 miles an hour. Who can do that? Who can maneuver?
Well, now let me ask you.
Around a missile.
If we don't have real, you know, solid evidence, documentary evidence that it is the Atomic Energy Agency, let me propose a speculation of, and let me see what you think about the possibility of it. Through the years, we know the FBI has been interested, and there are hundreds, if not thousands, of documents from the FBI related to UFOs that have been released through Freedom of Information. Yes. The CIA, though they said they weren't interested, there have been tons of documents released by them that show they, at least at one point, have been interested. I'm not aware of any NSA documents related to this, but I would assume there are some. So here's
some
a possibility.
I think Stan Friedman got some that have the Umbra stamp on them. But go on.
Could there have been a time when all of the various agencies and perhaps various parts of the military appointed people to a joint working commission that took on a life of its own?
I think that's the most likely scenario, considering all the information that you and I have learned and researched. I think that this probably took on a life of its own, became the guiding force or the HQ for the headquarters for any and all UFO related information and planning tactics, how to deal with leaks, how to deal with educating the public. You know, this process that we're going through now, the disclosure process, particularly since Stevensville, the purported UN UFO meeting, the Pope giving the Vatican dispensation on UFO belief. I heard all of this described in 1966 by Frank Edwards. Frank Edwards at the time had written Flying Saucer Serious Business, and he was interviewed on the Ellen Burke Show, which was a very, very intelligent talk show, WNEW in New York. Watch it all the time. So there's Frank Edwards, and he says that he said then that he had it on, from a reliable source within the CIA, that the Flying Saucers are serious business, but the American public has to be acclimated to it, and it's going to be done in 7 cycles of 7 years. I may have mentioned this before in a previous.
No, you didn't, but we have a break coming up. I want to get to that 7 cycles of 7 years when we come back from this break. It's the first time I've heard that, and I really want to dive off into that. Also, when we come back from this break, we're going to open the telephone lines. And you can call with your questions or comments for Robert Morningstar. The telephone number is 1-623-581-5148. Don't panic if you didn't get it. We'll put it on the screen when we come back. We'll be back after this.
Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com.
get it all. Become a member at kevinsmithshow.com.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I am Kevin Smith, your host, and we are into our second hour. During the break, I checked the email and got an email from Larry who says, "Hey, the website still shows the Wednesday show." Larry, you just told on yourself. I explained all that right at the beginning of the show, and that means you weren't there. Busted, buddy. Busted. All right. My guest is Robert Morningstar, and we will open the telephone lines in just a moment. A couple of things I want to cover first.
Robert, tell us about that seven cycles of 7 years.
Right. So this is around, let me just say 1966. I know that I was junior or senior in high school, and he was on for 2 years. So let's say it was about 1966. I know that Flying Saucer Serious Business had already been published, so that might be 66, 67. Regardless of that, Frank Edwards, who had vast contacts in journalism and in the government, claimed that he had been in contact with a reliable source at CIA, and that he'd been told that the American public wasn't ready for it, but that they were going to be groomed and prepared psychologically for it on a timetable of 7 cycles of 7 years. And he predicted, looking back onto the monsters from outer space, you know, it came from outer space, I married a monster from outer space, Plan 9 from outer space, the genre of the 1950s, the horrible invasion from Mars from some alien race from some local planet of our solar system. He said that this was what was necessary at that time, but that the American public would be slowly acclimated as a new genre or style of space movie would be coming out in which aliens would be depicted differently. And he predicted that in the 70s we would see movies about human alien interaction of a more peaceful nature, giving us a view of extraterrestrials who are not local monsters of the local solar system, and that each 7 years a new I guess I would say every 7 years one layer of the secrecy would be removed slowly over time until the 7 layers were removed, which would be 49 years. You know, let's make it 50 years. 50 plus 1966, you know, that leads us 2016?
That's about right,
so,
yeah.
You know, so 2016, 15, 13, we're hearing all these numbers. Well, it seems to me like maybe we're in the last, maybe it's also been moved up.
Yeah, the last layer of the onion.
Yeah, the last layer of the onion coming off. But
all right, there.
Also, I should say also that there is another group which believes that, as some say, that Wernher von Braun warned us that the alien issue would be used as one of the wars, that this whole thing of perpetual war is the only way to keep a military-industrial complex going, and that it would go, you know, through terrorists and threats of asteroids from outer space, and then finally an alien invasion would be the psychological ploy that would be used to keep marshaling and mobilizing the military-industrial complex that thrives on perpetual war. So that's another issue and perhaps a topic we can discuss another time.
All right, there are three names that I want to run past you. I think everyone is pretty familiar with these two names. First, Leslie Kane and sure. Richard Dolan. Leslie, of yep. course, is a noted journalist, and Richard yep. Dolan, a noted author and yep. researcher. All right, now, each of them have published two articles. in which they name three individuals that Edgar Mitchell knows, and the email that I have sort of indicates that perhaps these are individuals that have briefed Edgar Mitchell about extraterrestrial realities and presence. Now, these three names I'm not breaking any secrets here. I'm not breaking any news. I want folks to understand that. This has already been published. These articles are out there. But the three names in these articles are Thomas Wilson, Willard Miller. Both of these are Navy Pentagon. They are listed as respectively as J2 and J3. And Clark McClelland of NASA.
Yes.
What do you know about Clark, that?
Well, Clark McClelland is a very dear friend of mine, and we've been in touch for a few years. He saw things while at NASA that he apparently wasn't supposed to see, and even though he was a science officer and throughout the Apollo program, he got canned. And he's written a book that he's looking to publish, and it's full of amazing amazing stories, facts, photos, one of which is that, and he released this today, that he was watching a broadcast of a shuttle mission and that he saw an interaction between one of our astronauts and a 7 or 8 foot tall alien in the shuttle bay, and that he could see keeping station behind the shuttle parked out there a triangular craft that was apparently the source of this 7-8 foot tall alien. Now that
so Clark McClelland told you this personally?
Yes, he told it to me personally quite a while ago, but there was a release today, a press release that he put out, in which he states it explicitly for the first time. And just before the show came on, he said he wrote me an email that he would be listening in, and because I had put out some talking points that I saw that we'd talk about Nick Pope and Edgar Mitchell and UN, and he said, "You're not going to talk about me."
Well, if he's listening, we're talking about him now. His ears are
That's
burning
right.
now. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, listen, I have something to say about this. Now, this story, this account, this testimony, I call it testimony, it's not a story. He saw it, he's a witness, it's his testimony, he attests to it. I believe him. I'll tell you why I believe him, because about 2 years ago, I think, I was watching one of those NASA has a 4 or 5 DVD package of the shuttle missions, includes The Blue Planet, The Dream is Alive, and so on, several of the shuttle missions. And in one of them, they have a little snip of tape showing the launching of the Eris satellite. And it's a back of the shuttle bay view looking backward. You can see the vertical stabilizer of the shuttle. You can see where they start to spin the satellite, and it's kind of like golden and silver. And
I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah, well, everyone pays attention to the gold and silver and all the pretty colors, but I have this habit, trained after many, many years. I've talked about the fact that there are 256 shades of gray from white to black, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's the scale. Mm-hmm. Well, I found that most humans really look at only about 178 shades from white to probably dark gray in the borderline black, but I've trained myself to look into the black. You know, whenever something's being shown to me, especially NASA stuff, I'm always looking at the background. I'm not looking at what the subject of that is, and I'm scanning. So in this particular scene, I look and I see two or three dim white lights out there behind the shuttle and beyond the shuttle. And I'm looking at them, and I said to my friend, stop the DVD. Can you play this back? So there I went, and we stopped it on this, liquid plasma television, and the resolution was fantastic. I said, well, look at this. What is this? And what is this? These three white lights, and they were three corner points. You got any three corner points, what do you have?
You got a triangle,
right?
Yeah.
And I was looking. I said, look, you know, Tony, these are wingtip lights. Look at this. These are lights on the corners. There's something there. There was something blacker than the black. You know what I mean? I can see those things. And I said, I'll be damned. I bet you that that is a black triangle UFO parked there, keeping station behind the shuttle. So that's, you know, almost 2 years ago. Last February, when the UN meeting thing came around and all of that intrigue was going on, the New York Times came out with an article on space junk, you know,
yeah,
and how much of it there is. And they used this picture, color picture, of the Earth, given, you know, given to them by NASA, and there in the middle is this black triangle.
Huh.
You know, that again, this slow process of acclimating the public, first on a subconscious level, and then on the conscious level. Well, I snapped up that picture, and I said, holy mackerel, look at that space junk, the most perfectly beautiful equilateral triangle that you're ever going to see flying over the clouds of Earth. And I put out a notice. I said, anybody know where this picture comes from? So a friend of mine from TAP 10, which is an energy-oriented group, you know, zero-point energy and alternative fuels, sent me three copies of it, and it said Eris on it, E-R-I-S.
Yeah.
Which is the name of the satellite. So the label that NASA had on this picture that had been given to the New York Times, when I pulled it off the Times and I read it, it said Eris. Then I had seen the launching of the Eris satellite in this DVD. And
so you think it's the same black triangle?
Well, this is what now Clark McClellan says, that that's what was in the background, and I think it's talking about the same mission. I think we're talking about the Eris launch mission, which would have been overseen by a big black triangle that was watching our astronauts.
But now he says that he also saw a 7 to 8 foot tall extraterrestrial standing, talking
in
with an astronaut.
Bay. Yeah, that's what he said. I didn't see that in the DVD, but...
Oh, well, you know, those things can be taken out.
Well, we have all of these things that do corroborate independently, because I saw that black triangle before I knew Clark McClellan's story about this. And I've read the things on his website, and I'm trying to find him a good, reliable publisher who, you know, will do justice to his book and, you know, be righteous. Because, you know, a lot of these people, a lot of these dedicated researchers have put in years and years of their lives and all of their resources, and many are in dire straits, you know. You, me, all of us, because we're not getting grants to do this work. We fund this on our own, you know, time, blood, sweat, and tears, you know.
Yeah, so, right out of the blue jean pockets, and the blue jeans have worn out.
To help each other.
Yeah. All right.
You'll be getting my donation soon, Kevin, because I think you do an outstanding job. And I encourage the listeners, listen, folks, we all need help. This costs money. Kevin Smith is doing a fantastic service to all of us. And really, just pitch in a little bit. You know, go on the website, hit donation. You know what? If 1,000 people gave $1, he'd have $1,000 to run his website and this whole fantastic operation that he has. So that's my pitch for Kevin Smith, because I really believe.
Well, I tell you, I appreciate that. And let me just take this opportunity to say, since you brought it up, for all of you who have donated, thank you so much. And for those of you also who, by the way, have purchased the Super Pack, the 10 shows on a CD. All of those have gone out. They've left here, so you should be getting them shortly. They went via snail mail, so however long it takes to get snail mail to you, they're on their way to you. All right, now, the telephone number, folks, if you have a question or if you have a comment, the telephone number is 1-623-581-5148. It's right here on your screen. And so you don't even have to remember it. You just look at your video and you can see it. 1-623-581-5148.
And we will accept your call starting now, all right? So you're, if you have a comment or if you have a question, that's the number to call. If you live outside of the United States or Canada, most people in the United States and Canada have some type of telephone plan where they can call, especially at nighttime, without it costing them anything for long distance. If you don't have that and you want that, let me, I don't get paid for this, but let me urge you to check into Magic Jack. Go to magicjack.com. Cost you $39.95, I think, and that's it for the year. And you just plug it into your computer and you got a phone. But if you're outside of Canada and you're outside of the United States, you can send me a flash message. Send it to flash@kevinsmithshow.com. flash@kevinsmithshow.com. But if you're inside of Canada, you're inside the United States, give me a call at 1-623-581-5148. Robert, did Clark McClellan describe this alien other than 7 to 8 feet tall?
That's about it. Just huge size. And, well, I understand that. I believe it was in a spacesuit. I would hope it's in a spacesuit.
Yeah, even the aliens need a spacesuit, I guess.
Yeah, I would think so. But you know what? I'm going to write to Clark and ask him for details.
All right, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, hi, Kevin. This is Ryan up in Washington.
Hi, Ryan.
I do think that if the government discloses that they should do it very, very slowly. I think they should, but they should start very, very slowly. Maybe just show a picture of an alien or two pictures of an alien or something, and to start to show it kind of slowly. But my question is, Morningstar, do you think if the government comes clean on what's going on, that we should grant immunity to a lot of the people that have been involved, because they might be facing criminal charges, to some of them, for...
You know, I've heard, thank you for the question, I've heard that recommendation many times, and I would say yes, grant immunity to any people who have been involved in this, as long as they didn't commit any crimes.
You know, I'll tell you what, I would say grant immunity, period.
Yeah.
And yeah, and I'll tell you why. There are going to be a lot of things that have been done that are sort of in the gray area. Maybe it's criminal and maybe it's not, you know?
Yeah.
Well,
The question is good. The suggestion is good. Mm-hmm. Anything that see, here, it's a very important question, because so many people want to tell the truth of what they know, and yet there is the real fear of retribution. Punishment, persecution, harassment. Look what's happening to Gary McKinnon right now. You know, this whole extradition ordeal that he's going through.
Yeah, but you know, I don't think that if you took the UFO element out of it entirely, and you just had a guy breaking into our government's computers, our Pentagon computers, everyone in the UFO community, if you take the UFO element out, would be calling for his extradition, because what he did was a crime.
Yes and no. If is the big word. If it were, you know, the Defense Department or something like that. NASA, that's the weird part. NASA is part of the Defense Department. You know, it's publicly, you know, just science-oriented agency, but everybody knows that, you know, they have very, very deep relationship with military space programs, liaisons.
Well, they even have letterhead that says Department of Defense on it.
Yeah, so yeah. It's really not the Jules Bergman ABC science show agency that it was pretending to be throughout the 60s. And I seriously believe that all the Apollo missions really were military missions. dressed
well,
up.
Well, here's the deal with McKinnon.
You know, pop science.
Let's say that Gary McKinnon did not break into NASA. Let's say he did not break into the Pentagon computers. He broke into yours. That's a crime.
Yeah, but the FBI isn't going after the hackers that that broke into my computer, you know, 2 years ago or downloaded those virus programs that want to extort $40
well,
to get off.
I understand, but I mean the point is that it is what he did is a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be so if he had done that to any computer in the world, it would be a crime. I do think, however, that he is facing, now this is all up for debate, this is my opinion, all right? I'll go ahead and label it. It's my opinion. I think he's facing, you know, if he were to get the maximum sentence, the total number of years he's facing is something like 60 or 70 years. And I think that is ridiculously high. However, it is a crime to break into someone's computer. He's admitted that he did it. He's never denied that he did it. And why he did it really doesn't matter. It's sort of like this. When you're investigating crimes, it works like this. I have a dead body over here, and it has been murdered. If all the evidence points to Robert Morningstar as the suspect, why you did it is between you and God and your therapist. I don't care why. If the evidence leads to you, then we have to deal with the fact that we have to now have a trial, and I have to prove that it was you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, McKinnon has, there's this possibility. McKinnon may get very minimal time. He may get a very minimal sentence. But I've been, honestly, I've been a little bit surprised at the UFO community because they seem to think that it's just because he got UFO evidence. We don't know that he did. He didn't save any of it. And what he's being tried for is not that. What he's being tried for is breaking into the computers.
Well, some people think that what he's being tried for is to lock up what he saw, much more than just.
Yeah, I don't. I tell you why I don't think so, because he did not save any of that to hard disk or to hard copy. He didn't save any of it, so. It's just his word that he saw it, and all they have to do is say he's nuts. We're into a break, and we'll be back right after this. Don't go away, folks.
Nowhere, somewhere, anywhere. Can't you see?
right, we are back, and my guest this evening is Robert Morningstar.
Robert, we need to go to the phone line first. So,
okay.
Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Well, it's easy to get you tonight. I'm surprised. It's Ryan again. Come on, people. It's a good time to call in and ask Robert Morningstar a question. I might as well ask one more, and it was that... do you think that possibly the reason why they haven't disclosed yet is because it's been it took them a long time to figure out what they have? Like, maybe they don't even know. Maybe the government doesn't even.
Maybe they really don't know what they've got.
But on the Gary McKinnon thing, I was referring to was people that are in the military that. A lot of them are probably just following orders, but Gary McKinnon was kind of somebody that was just a rogue person that was breaking the law.
Yeah, but I have to say, you brought up some important points, but I think that Gary McKinnon has rendered both a public service to the American people and a civil service to NASA. First, he's shown NASA how permeable their security is. Okay, it's an embarrassment, but he did them a favor because now they can fix it. Secondly, he has done a public service to the American people by exposing to us an organization that is bilking us for trillions of dollars over decades and lying to us about it. Okay? That's the way I feel about it. If NASA is a scientific organization, I believe in open science. I don't believe in black science. And I believe that the people who own the programs, that's the American people who pay for them, ought to know what's going on, especially now. Okay, yes, well, there was a need for secrecy. We had a Cold War. We had a terrible and evil adversary. And secrecy was necessary, yes, okay. We had to keep secrets about UFOs and the metallurgy, and we had to keep the secret that we believed in UFOs from the Russians, right, so that they wouldn't have a hint that we were onto it and that we were developing or researching sources of UFO energy or materials.
Well, and those enemies from the Cold War...
They've fallen away.
To some degree. It's not a Cold War now. It's more of a cool war.
Mm-hmm.
We have some new folks out there that are... here's the deal. There was a great ideological difference between the United States and the Soviet Union. There is a great ideological difference between us, say, and the leader of Iran. The difference is that there was, in the Soviet Union, though there was a great ideological difference, there was still evidence of great sanity. They didn't want to do anything to precipitate a tremendous loss of life for their people.
Right.
But there are nations led by men now who really don't care if all of them get martyred. And so I think there's still a need for secrecy of some of the technological stuff. However, let me ask you, let me go back to Gary McKinnon.
Mm-hmm.
If you were on his jury, because apparently he is going to be extradited, if you were on his jury, would you vote, and they presented the case solely on the basis of, here's what he did. He broke into this computer. He broke into this computer. Here's the records of him breaking in and how we know. Would you vote for conviction or would you vote not guilty?
Well, feeling the way I do, I would not go with the letter of the law. I would listen to my own beliefs about what I've said and his motivation and the real result. What was the damage? You know,
uh-huh.
And in this case, I've been thinking about the case of the devil and Daniel Webster. You know, guy made a deal with the devil, and then he's brought before the jury, and then the jury itself decides that he was, just to beat the devil, let him go.
All right, let's go to the telephone caller. You are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Don. Calling from Phoenix.
Hi, Don.
How you doing tonight, bud?
Good.
I would like to get Robert's opinion on this. And now, I brought this up before. I know you disagree with me, so please let me finish first.
I will.
Okay, Gary McKenna, if I remember correctly, he did not break in. He did not hack. What he said he did, he found a way in that did not require a password. If something does not require a password, then that makes it public usage. He went in, and they're trying to say he hacked it, but he did not really hack into anything. If he did not have to enter through a password, then this was available for public use. And it was their fault, their mistake. And to claim it was hacking or breaking in is misleading.
Well, now, if that's the case, then that might be a good angle for his defense attorney to take.
I would tend to agree with this gentleman. Thank you for bringing that back to my recollection. And, again, what he did is he showed how shabby the purported security was. He did not run a password, right. He found all of these machines that were left open, basically, so that anyone could...
Well,
so there was no deception.
I don't remember that, and I don't dispute it.
I do recall reading...
But if that's the case, I think that would be a good angle for his defense attorney.
That's a good point. I'm in touch with a gentleman named David Griffin, who is working on defending Gary McKinnon, and he's been working on it in the UK, and we're going to be publishing an article by David Griffin in defense of McKinnon. It's a very important point. My point is that, as I said, he has done the American people a public service by showing us, A, how transparent the NASA computers were, and secondly, the deception that is ongoing,
Well, yeah. Now,
so
I think we also have to say that I'm not sure about how the law is written about getting into somebody's computer with or without a password. It may still be illegal. I don't know about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly think if that was the case, that there were no passwords required, I think that at least could be a mitigating factor and could be brought up in the defense.
I think you're right. I think that I'm going to forward that to David Griffin and also a large group. There's a large list of people in the United States who are very interested in this topic and defend Gary's. We're talking about freedom of information, Here's another problem that I have is what national security secret has he stolen if NASA says there are no UFOs? How can they argue that he's stolen anything if there's nothing to the UFOs in the first place?
Well, I read one article where they published some of the messages that he posted in a computer that was used for logistics for ordering supplies for one of the fleets. And for keeping that fleet supplied, and it said something like, "I am Solo, and I will continue to harass because you Americans have become the focal point of evil on the planet," or something like that. If they can prove that he posted that in that computer, they've pretty well got him nailed.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see. I hadn't heard about that. But can we talk about Edgar Mitchell for a moment?
Let's do that.
We're running out of time. Thanks for the call. Thanks for the heads up on that, by the way, caller. I appreciate it. Edgar Mitchell, I think of all the astronauts, is He is a very significant personage for this reason. I believe that Edgar Mitchell is the only astronaut to have had a close encounter on his trip to the moon with an extraterrestrial intelligence. And I think that experience that he had downloaded a tremendous amount of information, and it may have been a downloading from a cosmic intelligence or an upwelling of knowledge and remembrance that's in the human being, that when the human being is capable under circumstances, quest or crisis, you know, if you're looking for it, or sometimes a crisis will put you in a state of consciousness where your ego is no longer there and you have full access to the full repository of human knowledge as it's encoded in your DNA. I believe that we have individual memory. We have
So you're saying that encoded in us is a tremendous amount of information we're not aware of.
But it's there.
Okay.
And I believe that these peak experiences, and I have had my own. I share a lot in common, more than Dr. Mitchell realizes. I share a lot in common with him. Our interest in parapsychology, our study of the work of J.B. Ryan. He followed the path to become a pilot and an astronaut. I followed the path of pilot and psychologist. And the turning point for me was actually, I was signed up in a U.S. Air Force ROTC program when I was at Fordham University. And I was all psyched on being an astronaut. Then I went to see 2001 A Space Odyssey, and I that was an overwhelming life-altering experience, because this inner voice said to me at the climax of the film, where you want to go, Robert, you can't get there in a rocket. Psychology is the way. And it was talking about this understanding called the peak experience in Maslow's psychology, and that's the lingo that Edgar Mitchell uses, but other people call it cosmic consciousness. And he had a very eloquent description of his experience in the Kerrang radio interview. He gave a one of the most succinct and beautiful expressions of the experience, basically saying that when he was coming back from the moon, spinning in this space capsule, and seeing the alternation of sun and sky and stars and moon and earth and sun and sky and stars and earth and moon and so on, that he suddenly, first of all, the stars don't twinkle in outer space. They're steady. And he said that he felt his being remembering that every molecule and every atom in his body came out of stars, and that this raised his consciousness to another level. And I believe that this experience of cosmic consciousness, you know, Edgar Mitchell may be David Bowman from 2001 A Space Odyssey. Remember that the whole thing was about a space trip through the Stargate, et cetera, et cetera, and arriving at this understanding of human consciousness and its purpose in the universe, its where it's coming from, where it's going. We don't know where we really came from, but we have an inkling of where we ought to go, and it seems to be thrusting us to expand, to leave the planet, to spread humanity beyond our local neighborhood. But this consciousness that Mitchell experienced may be the most important thing of the whole moon trip.
Robert, we have to take a break. Folks, we will return right after this, and we'll take one or two more calls. Don't wait. You're running out of time, all right? We'll be back right after this.
Get it all. Become a member at KevinSmithShow.com.
Thank you. iPod? Get K-Pods, the Kevin Smith Show podcast, and take Kevin with you everywhere. Subscribe today at kevinsmithshow.com.
And we are back. My guest this evening is Robert Morningstar. And, man, have we been covering some ground. Robert, let's go
back to the telephone very quickly.
Sure.
Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Good evening, Kevin. This is Steve from Texas.
Yeah, Steve.
I've got a question for Robert.
Uh-huh.
You know, in your book, I haven't read your book, but I want to get it and read it, but... You know, I think that what you believe is that there was some biblical figures that claimed to be not from this earth or from another place. And if that is a common belief, that and I think the Bible kind of goes that direction, could we not say or conclude that the world is being led toward the return of these biblical figures? Once again, what I'm really saying is, have aliens already been here and documented in the Bible, and perhaps what we're looking for as far as disclosure is actually the proverbial return? And I'll hang up and listen to it.
I would agree with you, actually. I'm a person who studies history and mythology, and people dismiss mythology. But I like to tell people today that the science of today will be the mythology of tomorrow. It's all relative knowledge. But I believe the definition of myth that Joseph Campbell gave in his final book, Myths to Live By, came from a three-year-old boy, a third grader, who a teacher asked, who knows what myth is? He raised his hand and the teacher said, what's a myth? And he said, a myth is something that's true on the inside but not on the outside. So in every myth, the purpose of a myth is to continue and to carry on an important body of information, an essential detail, essential fact, or a code. I believe that the Bible gives plenty of evidence, not just our Judeo-Christian Bible, but I think the sacred writings of India, the Hindus, the Vedic civilization, the ancient Chinese, the Iraq, my God, the cradle of civilization. They all have initiations that come from star beings, or in the case of the Middle East and Mesopotamia, Awanis, a fish-like, upright fish-like creature that came out of the sea and taught them science and civilization. Curiously, that god, the fish god of the Mesopotamians, evolves into a tradition that's adopted by the Hebrews when they are in captivity in Iraq and they return to the Middle East with Judaism. And this evolves into the coming of a Messiah, Jesus Christ, whose symbol is the fish. So, you see, this fishman mythology runs through from the cradle of civilization in Samaria into Judaism, into Christianity, and this whole thing about the fish god, symbol of Christ. The watchers in the Bible... Genesis,
well, now, before we get away from the fish god, are you saying that, from your point of view... that there was an actual fish god type being, half man, half fish sort of thing that came out of the ocean? Do you think that's literally true?
I believe that, have legends of mermaids and mermen. We have now, just to jump into the modern era, the belief that there are many, many UFO bases beneath the sea. We have beliefs of an ancient kingdom of the sea kingdom of Atlantis with possible survivors. So the initiation, according to their history, came from Oannes, O-A-N-N-E-S, Oannes,
which is very similar to Johannes. So there's a book I'd love to recommend to everyone. It's called The Key by John Philip Cohane, C-O-H-A-N-E. I think it's one of the most important books ever written on language. And the key is that Cohane discovered by studying world languages that there are six basic sacred sounds in all languages, which seem to be the building blocks of all the concepts of the holy and the sacred. And these six sounds are Ak, Og, Ash, Eloah, Hawa, and Mana. And that from the recombination of these sounds, nature and the world was invested with sanctity and holiness, but that he believes that these six sounds are the remnant of an antediluvian civilization, a world civilization that fell but left its mark in the languages, in the most sacred sounds and concepts of world languages. So if you can find a copy of The Key by John Philip Cohane, you'll really see, your eyes will change when you read words like Chicago and Milwaukee or Monongahela. Native American words are imbued with these sacred words. So, yes, I believe that there has been intervention, and that this intervention has been called angels and demons throughout the ages, or fairies, or the good people in Ireland, Scotland, kobolds in Germany, subterranean creatures who are into mining and metallurgy, Krishna, who rode around on a blue bird called Garuda, always dancing in the forest with many gopis, you know, milk maidens, chanting them. All of this sounds to me like the same scenario being played out in different epics and different civilizations. And the experience is masked for each individual within the context and the symbol structure of their particular civilization. So Judeo-Christians would say fairies, devils, angels, demons. You know, the Celts would say fays, or leprechauns. You know, the Native Americans would say it's Mescalito hopping around the roof and making mischief. So it's a phenomenon that's been with mankind since the beginnings of civilization. And man has struggled for words to express it. But it's even in the Dead Sea Scrolls. If you read the Dead Sea Scrolls, you'll find references to the angels coming and going to Qumran, to the Essene community, on chariots of glory. And there's even a description of a tent in the center of the Essene community where they would meet with the angels and apparently have intercourse with the angels. And there were very strict laws of hygiene and purification, especially for women who came in contact with angel seed. Now, if an angel's got seed, you know, he can't be totally ethereal. Yeah? So the mysteries are being unraveled, and linguistics is a very important tool in this investigation.
I think you've revealed to us here part of the Dead Sea Scrolls that has not previously been widely publicized. Can you suggest a book that people can check to maybe get it out of the library or go buy it, where we can read that?
I believe there's a book by a gentleman named Eisen, Michael Eisen. And that's my favorite. It has the Hebrew and it has the English translation. And it's the most detailed one that I have ever read. I've been reading snippets of the Dead Sea Scrolls for 50 years. Israel quashed the Dead Sea Scrolls for 45 years, and I couldn't understand why.
We're going to have to wait till next time to find out why, because the end of the show just hit us in the face, Robert. I want to thank you for being with us, and if you will stay on the line with me for a moment, Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. That's a wrap for this evening. Thank you for being here. If you haven't gotten your super pack yet, be sure that you click that and watch the ad. Get your super pack because it's only going to be available for a couple of more days, all right? My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. And you can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Be sure you're here tomorrow night. We've got Walter Bosley coming. It's always interesting when he's here. Until then, so long, everybody.